welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 190 of the podcast, coming up on 200, and it is the 28th of July 2014 as I release this. I'm actually recording a little bit in advance as I'm flying to Toronto tomorrow. My brother is getting married and then I'm visiting Kobo in Toronto to do an evening Q&A and meet some authors, which I'm really excited about actually. I love that with our online world, we can make, you know, friends on Twitter and through social media and things, and then meet people in person. And I wish everyone would wear their Twitter handles there instead of name badges with their real names, because I never know people's names. I often know people better by their Twitter handles. Anyway, so I'm off to Toronto. Today I have an interview with James Scott Bell on writing dialogue. And James has, of course, written a lot of books on the craft. He's written a lot of different fiction styles as well, from historical romance to legal thriller to zombie legals, which I think is pretty awesome. James, I get a little deeper with James because he's been on the show before, so I can rib him a little and ask him some naughty questions. The tricks on dialogue are actually useful whether you write fiction or non-fiction, as most narrative non-fiction these days includes story and snippets of dialogue that help to bring the text alive, so that's cool. And we're also talking about Thrill Ride, which is a box set with 8 award-winning best-selling thriller authors in, available right now on all ebook platforms. Now I'm doing the big push on this on my blog on the 31st of July, so if you are listening before then, that's why I haven't tooted a big horn about it as yet, but I wanted you guys to know if you listen to the podcast. So Thrill Ride is, obviously I was in Deadly Dozen earlier this year in February, which was amazing, sold 100,000 copies, made the New York Times list, USA Today list. No, this is, you know, maybe an attempt at doing that again, but it's essentially, I'm really pleased with this one. It's I like Thrill Ride as a title. It's also got a motorcyclist on the front, which is cool because my character, Jamie Brooke, rides a motorbike, and Thrill Ride contains desecration. Now, desecration is on, it's a full price, full length novel, and this Thrill Ride box set contains 8 pulse-pounding novels from 8 different authors, with an introduction by Steve Berry. The tagline is murder, conspiracy, corruption, kidnapping, demons, fugitives, and a world poised on Armageddon. Between us, the books have over 600 reviews across everything, with a solid 4.4 star average across 600 reviews, $30 value, and available in a very limited time for 99 cents. So 8 full-length thrillers, 99 cents, you can't go wrong. And there's some, I won't read everybody, but certainly The Roswell Conspiracy by Boyd Morrison is in there, which is action-adventure. Boyd, obviously about Roswell. Boyd now writes with Clive Cussler, so that's pretty cool. James Scott Bell obviously has Blind Justice, which is a legal thriller in there. My Desecration is in there, and that was meant to be a straight crime thriller, but turned into supernatural suspense, so has a psychic in. Detective Sergeant Jamie Brooke and clairvoyant Blake Daniel delve into London's macabre world of grave robbery, body modification, and the genetic engineering of monsters to stop a murderer from claiming another victim. So yes, Desecration is in there. an interesting one by Randy Ingemanson is in there with Double Vision, PJ Parrish with The Killing Rain, The Blade by Lynn Scholes and Joe Moore, Sidetracked by Brandy Lynn Collins, and The Call by Kat Covell. I don't know if I said that already. But actually, The Call by Kat is really interesting. After a near-death experience, down on his luck mythology geek and self-proclaimed loser Sam Wilson is pulled into a dangerous quest. Silence a demonic sound lethal only to angels, so that exiled angels can return to Earth, or mankind will die. Sounds like my kind of book. So certainly kick-ass beach read. Let's go for beach read, shall we? Fun thrill ride. So you can find all the store links. I've put all the links up. It's available now at Amazon, iBooks, Kobo, Nook, and actually only for the US and Canada, sorry if you're not there, because some of these authors have sold other rights. So if you don't own the worldwide rights, you can't put it in a box set without the publisher saying so. So unfortunately only US and Canada, 99 cents. You can find the store links at jfpen.com/thrillride, or you can buy directly on Amazon at smarturl.it/thrillride, and obviously available at all the other bookstores as well. So I hope you like the sound of that. I'm pretty pleased with it. I think it's a good box set. I think we've got a good chance of doing well. So if you want to try, oh, and what I should say, which is even more exciting, is Desecration is in the box set at a reduced price. And then Delirium, the next in the series, is on soft launch. And I'm excited about this too, because Delirium has been a really hard book to write. I wanted to do something around, because Desecration is really about the physical body and the difference between the physical body and the spiritual body. I wanted to do something around mental health, and the opening murder is the historical Bedlam. It was Bethlehem Hospital, but became known as Bedlam, and that now gives us the word for kind of crazy. But Delirium is now available in very soft launch, as in, again, you're getting a sneak peek because I haven't announced it on the blog. But the links are at jfpen.com/delirium. And it actually has a very personal author's note at the back about some of the things that have happened in my life that, I think I probably could have been diagnosed with something. I mean, maybe we all feel that. I personally believe mental health mental illness is a spectrum that we all sit on and we all move up and down on different points in our life. And so the book has been a real personal journey. I mean, it's essentially, it is a crime thriller. There's a murder. We have to solve the murder. But it also, Blake Daniel, there's a whole lot about his family, there's a whole load of demons in it, which I think is quite interesting. Probably not selling it so well, but I have been talking about it for a long time. I started this about 14 months ago. So it's been a journey, for sure. This is my podcast, so I'm going to read my blurb. So Delirium, those who the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad. When a prominent psychiatrist is found murdered in the old hospital of Bedlam, Detective Sergeant Jamie Brooke finds herself investigating the history of madness to fathom the motive. Blake Daniel, a reluctant psychic, helps her to research the case, only to discover that his own family are entwined with the shadowy forces that seek to control the minds of the mad. As the body count rises and those she loves are threatened, Jamie discovers that the tendrils of conspiracy wind themselves into the very heart of the British government. Can she stop the killer before madness takes its ultimate revenge? A thriller with an edge of the supernatural, Delirium is a story of love for family, revenge for injustice, and the question of whether we all sit on the spectrum of madness somewhere. There you go. So I'm breathing a big sigh of relief to have this finished and can go to Canada and have a few too many champagnes to celebrate. But you can find out more about that at jfpen.com/delirium, or you can just search Delirium on the ebook stores, and it will be coming out in print shortly. So, yeah. Right, let's get into the interview. And first of all, a word from our sponsor. The podcast is sponsored by Cobo Writing Life. Here's a little advert before we get into the interview.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Nathan Maharaj, Director of Merchandising for Cobo. As Kobo's head bookseller, I'm thrilled to be working alongside the Cobo Writing Life team as they usher in the new era of digital publishing. One of the most exciting trends I'm seeing today is self-published authors and hybrid authors who are climbing out of the 99-cent price band to offer their work for prices comparable to titles from major publishers. These authors have clearly made investments to make their ebooks the best they can be. From cover design and copy editing to thousands of hours of scribbling away honing their craft. And they're not afraid to ask a competitive but fair price for their work. However you publish, it's a great time to be a writer and an even better time to be a reader. I hope to see you on Kobo soon.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and today I'm here with James Scott Bell. Hi James!
How are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you back on the show. So just as a little introduction, James is the best-selling and award-winning author of thriller novels, zombie legals, historical romance, and lots of books on the craft of writing. He's a professional speaker, teaching novel writing and other skills for writers, and his latest book is How to Write Dazzling Dialogue, which we're talking about today, and is something that I definitely struggle with. So this is going to be a great discussion. So, Jim, tell us a little bit, I guess, why is dialogue so important anyway? Can't we just write lots of paragraphs with no one talking to each other?
Well, that would be wonderful if you didn't want to sell books, if you wanted to bore readers to death. Well, of course, dialogue is a great part of what we do, and the better it is, the more readable the book is. What I've found, too, is I like to tell people that dialogue is the fastest way to improve a manuscript because agents and editors and even readers who aren't really analyzing it, they just know when the dialogue isn't working, when it's flat, when it sounds the same. But when dialogue is really crisp and differentiated and full of conflict and tension, it really stands out, and it allows the person who's reading it to feel confident in the writer and to get more involved in the story. So it's really crucial, especially if someone is trying to pitch their novel to an agent or an editor. If they can put really good dialogue in those first few pages, it'll make a big difference in the positive effect that they generate.
Mm. And before we go on into the detail, even in nonfiction now, people are telling little stories, aren't they, in chapters, and using dialogue can even be a way to bring alive nonfiction.
Absolutely. The use of fiction techniques in what's called narrative nonfiction is hugely important. And in my workshops, I'll always have a handful of people who are nonfiction writers, and it's great for them.
Mm, yeah, so this is relevant to everyone. So one of the big things that I certainly did and have to now delete from my manuscripts is the overuse of names in dialogue, which of course we generally don't do in when we talk. So can you explain what that problem is and how to fix it?
Well, yeah, one of the things to watch for in dialogue in general is that when two characters are talking, they should not be giving each other the information that both of them already know. Because if they do that, it sounds like the author is trying to slip that information to the reader. And names is one of the ways that you can do that. Like you said, overusing names is, we wouldn't do that because the person I'm talking to knows their name and so do I. So I think it's just something to watch for. You know, these little quirks that pop up in our, not just our dialogue, but you probably find this, when you write a manuscript and somebody else reads it, you'll find that, you know, you've been using the same expression over and over again. And sometimes it changes from book to book. So that's just something to watch for on revision. And just always be thinking that when two characters are talking to each other, they should not be feeding each other information that both of them already know.
Mm.
And that kind of applies to the backstory and that exposition, right? So I shouldn't be saying, hey, Jim, remember when we were both at that camp and that happened and this happened? And, you know, that's a sort of false way of using it too, right?
Yeah. Now, this brings an interesting point. You know, bad exposition dialogue, which I find sometimes that new writers are using, and they think they're being very clever and hiding the information. But, you know, it's sort of like, you know, a character opens the door and says, oh, hello, Arthur, my family doctor from Baltimore, you know, that sort of thing. So one of the ways to but backstory information, and especially things from the past that maybe the character wants to hide, there are ways that you can get those out in dialogue. And one of the best ways is to get the people into an argument. When the information is being thrown at another character sort of as a weapon, it's a much more natural way for that information to come out. So I say sometimes take your exposition and turn it into a confrontation, and then it will sound more natural.
Ah, that's a good one. That really is. I like that. And how about differentiating voices in dialogue? I mean, how far should one go?
I think that's crucially important. One of the things that I teach in my workshops, and something that I do very early on in any book that I write, is create a voice journal for each character. And what I mean by that is I start a document that's like a free-form, flowing speech being made by the character talking to me. And I might even prompt with questions and so on. But I allow my imagination to just keep creating words until, and this happens every time, until the character starts to take on kind of a voice of its own. And then I'm hearing that character in a new way, and that becomes the sound of it. And if I do that with all the major characters especially, but even minor characters too, then I find that the voice differentiation takes care of itself, making sure that the characters are different. I call this orchestration too. And one of the things I say in my workshops is that great dialogue begins before you write it by how you orchestrate your characters. And by creating characters that are different from each other in all sorts of ways, physically, mentally, educationally, socially, all of those ways, it provides areas for natural conflict between the characters. And if you do that, you'll find that the dialogue becomes a lot more natural.
So when you're planning or plotting, do you make these character sheets with all of that up front? So that would be a plotter rather than a pantser approach.
Well, what I do before I can write a character, I have to both see and hear the character. So I do what a lot of writers do. When back before we were all using the internet, I would buy magazines and cut out pictures, headshots of the characters, you know, that kind of resonated with me. Now you can get those images on the internet. I want to have a headshot because one that sort of awakens a feeling in me about who this character is. And then I want this voice journal that I spoke about, and then a few basic things about the character and, you know, backstory, a little bit of that, a little bit of the timeline of their life. But once I get that in place, the character begins to sort of take on a life of their own.
And how do you, because I think I do well with visual, because I'm a very visual person. I know I do badly with the audio stuff, which is why I struggle with dialogue. Do you research dialogue by, I don't know, listening to videos or audio, or do you listen to people on buses or if you go on buses, you know, how do you get that audio sense?
Well, it's a good question. You know, some people, they say, you know, maybe are born with a musical ear and so forth, but also people can be trained in music. I've always been, I used to be an actor. And so I always used to love to go, when I was living in New York, I'd just go to Times Square and I would just watch people. I'd go to diners and I'd listen. I love to do that and just absorb and then practice it when I was, for example, doing improvisation. In fact, that's one of the things I recommend to writers, is to take an improvisation class, you know, because it forces you to use that part of your imagination that is making stuff up on the fly. But yeah, I tend to listen to conversations that are going on around me and think about the way people are speaking. I think you can do that intentionally, and that will help a great deal.
That's interesting that you were an actor, because I think obviously actors have a great voice talent or develop that voice talent over time. So, you know, that's really interesting. And what about stereotypes? So I think media does this to us. So I was at a workshop with a lady from Nashville, and I could hardly understand a word she was saying. And I speak to Americans a lot. So I was like, this is really odd. And then my husband struggles with the Scottish accent. And when we hear things that potentially don't understand, we stereotype a character. What's the danger of putting an accent into a character that brings a stereotype?
Yeah, that's a good point, is that when you're trying to render an accent or a dialect, it can, if you allow it to overwhelm the dialogue, it does seem like a cliche. And so what I suggest is that when you're taking an accent, let's say a Scottish accent, for example, is that you season it with a little bit of dialect, but then let the reader's imagination fill it in from there. You don't have to write out, in fact, it's not a good idea to try to phonetically write out every word as if it would appear. That kind of technique is very old-fashioned and not in use anymore. But readers will go along with you if you make a suggestion of it, and then let the character himself or herself, through their actions and what they say, do the work of characterization.
And that's what I was going to say. So how do we weave action into dialogue without just using basic dialogue tags, as in he said, she said?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a strategy question, and it depends on the tone you're going for. It depends on the pace you're going for. Dialogue is a great way to increase the pace of a scene. If people are talking, there's white space on the page, they say. You know, that's a good thing sometimes to give readers sort of relief from large blocks of text. So if you want a feeling of a fast pace, you would use short, crisp dialogue and moderate the use of action. If you want to slow things down, you would increase the action. So it's really a matter of knowing your tools and then knowing the feeling that you want to generate on the page, and then you just moderate that way.
And I guess sort of going deeper into that, balancing, a line of dialogue with "she put her head in her hands," you know, versus "she said the same line of dialogue and leaped in the air."
Yeah.
So that you can use that kind of description to change the dialogue. Would that be correct?
Well, are you talking about using, say, just a little action beat instead of something like "she said"? Is that what
trying to, you don't always have to put an exclamation mark, for example, at the end of every line, which obviously some people do.
that's right. No, exclamation points are one thing that should be used very sparingly with writers, because it does feel a little bit like manipulation after a while. Well, yeah, now let me talk about attributions. "He said, she said." My theory on that is that the basic "he said" or "she said" or "he asked, she asked" is virtually invisible to the reader. They're not really, it doesn't pose, make them work any harder. And it does its job by telling them who's speaking. Now, for variety's sake, sometimes you put in, instead of that, a little action beat. But my feeling on that is that the action beat should have some relevance to the scene. I have seen some writers attempt to write a whole novel without ever using "he said" or "she said," and instead substituting these little actions. But what happens is, though, every time you write an action, it makes the reader work at visualization. And if they are innocuous, the reader's going to feel a little bit like this is a tougher read than it should be. So I don't advocate people doing that exclusively. Use it for variety's sake. Don't be afraid of "he said, she said." It does its work, gets out of the way, and it allows the dialogue to stand on its own.
And what about cursing? Because I used the F word, you know, I think twice in one book, and I got more complaints about that than about a kind of ritual murder, you know, of a child, actually. Mm. And I was like, what's going on there? So are there any guidelines, I guess?
Well, you know, this is a great sort of subject for controversy among writers. Some writers saying, look, if I'm writing a contemporary crime novel and it's going to be realistic, I'm going to have that kind of language. On the other hand, back in the 40s and 50s, people wrote these great crime novels without explicit language. So my feeling on that is that the writer is in full control. The writer can find ways to stylize language and scenes in virtually any way they choose. Now, the F word issue is that, yeah, you know, there's a group of people out there that offends. And but the author needs to make a judgment on that. You know, if they feel like they have to use that kind of language for their scene, then they will, and they'll take whatever the consequences are. My own view, my feeling is I don't need to do that, and I don't really care to do it, but I just think every writer should be informed about the pluses and minuses about it.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to ask about, like, subtext. Mm. Can you explain what subtext is and how that works with dialogue?
Well, subtext is a great technique for creating dialogue that isn't just plain surface-level dialogue. There's something more going on there that the reader will pick up. They'll pick up that, hey, wait a minute, the way that this character is responding is a little strange. That's because the writer knows what the subtext is. Now, subtext can be anything from previous relationships that the characters have with each other that aren't clear yet. It can be things from the past, backstory, secrets, things that have happened in the story thus far. One of the movies I like to use as an example is Casablanca. And there's a great scene in the early part of Casablanca where Rick is in his saloon and the new Nazi major who has come to sort of take over operations there sits down with Rick and with Louis, the little French captain, and another Nazi from the SS. And they have this great little surface conversation that seems all so friendly, but really it's the Nazi is trying to get the American to give up information. And they say things with all sorts of subtext. And one of the lines that Rick says when the major says, you know, what happens when we get into your beloved Paris? And Rick says, well, it's not particularly my beloved Paris. And why did he say that? Well, we don't know yet. But later we find out that Paris is where he met Ilsa and was betrayed by her, he thought. So that's all a way to get the dialogue to mean more than what's just on the surface level.
Mm. And you mentioned movies there. And recently I've watched the True Detective series, which absolutely amazing. And I just loved it. And I want to get hold of the screenplay, which I can't seem to get hold of it. And I wondered, well, first of all, asking you as an actor, where do we get screenplays from if we want to read them?
Well, there are sites out there. You can just Google.
I tried. I was like, True Detective script.
True Detective may not be available because it's recent. And they may be, you know, withholding dissemination of it. But if you're looking for screenplays of movie classics, for example, there are sites that make those available. And it's very instructive. I have some clips in my book from some of the classic movies to show, because the dialogue in those movies is so great, to show these various techniques. And they're available. If they're, you can just take a look at them, and you know, usually they're downloaded loadable PDFs, and they're wonderful ways to study dialogue.
And then I wonder, see, you might think this is obvious, but if I'm trying to learn from dialogue in a script, should I be reading that out loud? Because you find really great dialogue, like you say, you don't even realize it's happening. So in order to actually study dialogue, I'm trying to work this out, you know, it's do you read a script out loud and try and work it out?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. When you read out loud, you can even read great dialogue in a novel out loud as a way to sort of get that sound in your head. And it helps you to differentiate between characters and do all the things that we've been talking about. Mm. And there are also collections of screenplays in book form that you can find on Amazon and so on. Mm. So any of those items would be good for study. And like you said, reading out loud, just kind of looking at the words on the page. Sometimes even just one of the things I suggest in this book is to take a screenplay scene and then rewrite the dialogue, but make it a scene as if you were writing a scene in a novel, adding little actions and so forth. And that'll just kind of give you the rhythm of creating dialogue on the page.
Mm. Do you write screenplays as well?
Yes, I do. I started as a screenwriter, and that's really how I learned almost everything. Structure, scene writing, visual scene writing, dialogue, and all of those things. When the fiction started to take off, I really concentrated on that. But I've been able in the last couple of years to work on a couple of screenplays that are out there in development and so forth. So, I still try to keep my hand in that.
Well, that's interesting, going a bit off topic, but I'm going to go to London Screenwriters Festival because every time, you know, I talk to people like yourself and, you know, they say screenwriting can really help you with your book. And Chuck Wendig, I'm sure you know, says that only by doing a screenwriting exercise with his first book was he able to write a good book.
Yeah, I really, like I said, you know, I've written a book on plot and structure, as you probably know, and most of what I learned about structure, I learned from watching movies and analyzing and taking them apart and putting them back together again. And the right, when with a screenplay, you're writing mostly dialogue. Mm. And you're getting into a scene and out of a scene without a lot of hesitation. Mm. And that's really a great skill that many novelists need to learn too.
Mm. No, I'm fascinated by it. And I'm almost at the point of wanting to do an adaptation kind of idea. So yeah, anyway, that will be another discussion. But let's getting back to dialogue. What about humor? How does humor work with dialogue? Because I struggle with humor as well. I'm not very funny.
Well, one of the nice things about dialogue is, you know, we've all had the experience of driving home from a party and then thinking, oh, if only I had said this, the perfect line comes to you, you know, 20 minutes later or the next day. So you can work on it. Now, we both write suspense and thrillers and have a lot of high tension. I love to have what's called comedy relief within that structure. You know, my favorite director is Alfred Hitchcock. And Hitchcock was a master of slipping in humorous scenes, little clips, or even just characters within the tense action. And it's just such a wonderful feeling for readers and audiences, because it increases the sort of emotional connection with it. So I try to find, at the very least, make at least one quirky character. And by playing around with a quirky character, you'll find yourself, well, hey, this character says some funny things. And putting them in a situation, that's one way to do it. The other way is just to learn basics of comedy writing. I have a little booklet available on Amazon called How to Write Comedy, which is based on the comedy writing notes of a guy named Danny Simon, who's Neil Simon's older brother. And he taught Neil Simon and Woody Allen, and he taught this very famous comedy writing class in Hollywood. So I took it and took all these notes, because when he died, he didn't leave any books or anything. So he's got some very helpful ideas, too, about how you create even one great line. Let me give you one example. He called it curving the language. What you do, and I have this in my book, is that you write out a line, and it might be a cliche, it might be plain vanilla, and then you don't discard the line, but you tweak it. You play with the words in it. And, for example, Harlan Ellison, a science fiction writer, once wrote this line. He said, "She looked like a million bucks." Now, we've all heard that cliche before. So what do? How do you freshen it up? And the line that he came up with, he just added to it. He said, "She looked like a million bucks tax-free." And just that little bit of adding something makes the line a little shinier. And that's one of the ways you can kind of beef up your dialogue.
And it's interesting. I ask that about humor because I recently saw Shakespeare's Henry V, which I can't remember the name of the ridiculous character, but I was just like, we've just had this massive scene and now you've got this idiot kind of coming on. And then Game of Thrones does it as well on wow. that show. You know, they've got this awful massacre and then some kind of funny scene. And when you start paying attention to it, it's like you say, there's like a beat of lightness after massive death. And I need to
Shakespeare, like, he was a master at that, of course, right? He wanted to please the groundlings. And one of my favorite characters is the gravedigger in Hamlet, you know. So that's a perfect example about hearing this heaviness of that play. You have this wonderful character appearing. So again, quirky characters can make all the difference. In what it does is it elevates the emotional connection and the tone of the book. It gives it an extra flavor. And what readers do, they don't really analyze that. They don't say, he's adding an extra flavor. They just experience it. And when they finish the book, they think, wow, that was really great.
Great. So just one thing on punctuation. We mentioned exclamation marks, but I got the basic punctuation wrong when I started writing fiction. You know, as a nonfiction writer coming into fiction, there are some things that you don't know. So just give us a heads up on the correct punctuation for dialogue.
Well, in the book, I have a whole section of on punctuation. So every kind of nuance that arises, you can study. I mean, basically, all dialogue has punctuation. The punctuation goes inside the closed quote, and then if it's a comma, you don't capitalize the pronoun, like he said. If there's a period, you do capitalize it. There are things like that people need to know about. For how do you render an interruption in dialogue? Some people use the ellipsis, you know, the three dots, but that's wrong. The interruption is the M dash, which is the long dash. That's an interruption. And when you put an interruption like that, the M dash, you close quote, then the next line really needs to be the character who's doing the interrupting or the action that happens that interrupts. The ellipsis, the three dots, is when a voice trails off for some reason. He's lost in thought and so on. So just knowing those little subtle differences will help.
Yeah, and even those things I remember getting really wrong, and then, you know, the editor has to clean it up. And I feel that for editors, I mean, we can all have editors fix this stuff, but the less they have to fix, the more they can get deeper into the rest of the book, right? So we should know this stuff. You shouldn't rely on an editor to fix basic stuff like that.
Absolutely.
So the other question I had was, you write across multiple genres, and it was so funny when I went back to your website, because, of course, I knew you wrote thrillers and I knew you wrote legal things, but you've got zombie legals and historical romance. So I was like, wow, you know, you do everything. And my question about this was, does your dialogue differ by the genre that you're writing?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it does. Yeah, when I do a historical, for example, I really feel the difference. I mean, one of the craft secrets of writing historicals is knowing how to render dialogue that is not modern sounding, but yet not so archaic that people can't understand it. So for the historicals, I wrote a 6-book series that takes place around the turn of the century, 1900, in Los Angeles. And I read a lot of old newspapers of the day through microfilm and so on, and just kind of try to put myself back in the reading journals and diaries and so on to get it was a more expansive kind of language. So not a lot of sort of cutting off of words or compressing words. It was more expansive. And so, yeah, that's a difference. Then if I write something that's more humorous, for example, I write boxing stories written in first person that take place in the 50s in Los Angeles. And so I have a whole voice that I developed for that character. So, yeah, that's one of the fun parts, I think, for me, is just being able to write in different voices. That's what dialogue allows me to do.
And do you use speech to text at all?
I've done that some, but not a lot. I actually mostly prefer to type. But I've done some of that. And speaking out, I find it interesting. I think maybe you can talk about this. I find my writing's a little bit different when I do it that way than if I type it. Maybe that's just my perception, but do you find that there's a different style that emerges?
I can't do it yet. I'm trying to practice, but I thought with you, I think it's an important skill eventually to get to, because I know so many writers who get, you know, RSI and various issues. But I figure with nonfiction, it seems quite easy, but with fiction, I just couldn't even imagine it. But because you're an actor, you know, you've got the acting side. I thought maybe you could, you know, you get into these voices, you could like act it out.
That's actually not a bad idea. Thank you. I'll have to think about that. When I've used the dictation mode, it's usually been for sections of a nonfiction project, because when I write nonfiction, I like to write in a very conversational style. So it's easier for me to do it that way. So, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. It is interesting.
Yeah, one of the things I do say in my book is to practice dialogue is to actually, usually best done in the privacy of your own home, is to speak it out loud and improvise it verbally as you're developing it. I mean, start speaking the lines as the character. Speak it out loud. Do a scene between two characters, almost as if you were doing an improvisational exercise, because the auditory mode allows you to hear it in a different way in your head, and that helps to differentiate the speech too.
And then just one more question on audiobooks. I interviewed AJ Hartley, who did Macbeth with David Hewson for audio. They wrote for audio first. And they said it was a very different way of writing. And of course, many of us are now using ACX and getting our books out on audio. And I've noticed listening, I'm like, oh, maybe I would have written that differently. What are your guidelines if you're writing for audio? What do you have to do differently?
Interesting. I haven't really thought about writing differently for audio. I write the books. I put some of them on Audible via ACX, and I've hired the narrators to do that. But I've thought also, if I could just get the time, I've got a studio space. So now, if I could just get the time, I'd like to do some of my own reading and put those out there. So I might do that soon as well. And I would just imagine I would take the text as I wrote it and try to dramatize it.
Well, it's a fascinating thing to consider, isn't it? And yeah. I interviewed my narrator the other day, and she's an actress, and it's such a different mode. It really is very different. So when someone's listening to it versus when they're reading it, it's quite different. Anyway, what was I going to ask then? How many books have you got? You have so many books. How many books do you have out in the world right now?
Oh,
tough one.
Well, I think probably that are available, maybe 30 books or so. There could be one or two others, but you know, more and more I'm doing the independent publishing, as you are, and I'm loving that, simply because when a book is ready, you can put it out there and there's not a huge long wait. I do enjoy working with Writer's Digest Books, for example, and they're good. They've been very good folks to work for. So in the future, though, there may be still a mix of that. But the other thing I like is I'm a big fan of the novella form. I think that there are some stories, especially good crime suspense stories, that are really best told in about 40,000 words. So I'm going to be doing more of those as well. And in the traditional publishing world, those really have been a hard sell and haven't really taken off. But in the indie world, there's no reason why they can't.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because my last book was a novella, Day of the Vikings, and it was so much fun. I went to a Viking exhibition and then blew up the British Museum, basically, and it was I had fun. It was easy to write. It was the easiest, and I felt very satisfied, and it's selling well. And I was just like, this is great. You know, it's so hard to write a full-length book, isn't it? It's really hard just to hold everything in your head at the same time. And I feel like a novella, it's like a natural length. But maybe that's for me and for you, maybe not other people. But, you know, I'm glad to hear you say that. Fantastic.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there are some stories that, for example, one of the great pulp noir stories was The Postman Always Rings Twice by James M. Cain, written in the 30s. And really, I think that book is only about 30,000 words long, or 35,000, which is really a novella that they put out as in a little hardback, and it became the sensation. It became a movie. So it did everything it needed to do, but it only needed 35,000 words to do it. Mm. So having the freedom to stop when you're done is great.
Yeah, no, I agree. Right, so you do write lots and lots of fiction, and actually you and I are in a box set together, aren't we, called Thrill Ride, which is very exciting, and it's out now as we're recording this, and it has 8 full-length books, not novellas, full-length books, including my own supernatural suspense, Desecration, and your legal thriller, Blind Justice. So tell us about Blind Justice.
Well, Blind Justice is a legal thriller that is a straight-on legal thriller that where the case in court is really what the book is about. There's really two kinds of legal thrillers. One is where, you know, there's some mega bad guy after people, like in a John Grisham. But then there are others that where the courtroom battle is really the gist of it. And I'm a former trial lawyer, so I love getting into that idea. And so this is a story of a lawyer who is handling, his life is kind of crumbling, and he's got a young daughter that he needs to salvage a relationship with. At the same time, he's defending a childhood friend who's been accused of murder. And so I'm very excited to have that book included in our set. And what a great set it is, isn't it?
It is, definitely. And it's a lot of fun. And I'm asking all the authors this. So it's called Thrill Ride, and we've got a very exciting cover with a motorbike on, which is great because my character rides a motorbike in Desecration. So that's pretty
excellent.
Cool. So I want to know, what is most thrilling about you, Jim? Why are you in Thrill Ride?
Wow, you caught me with that. What is most thrilling? Well, I live in Los Angeles, and I know the place. So whenever any author comes out here, I can show them all the places where really famous murders took place. And so if anybody wants that kind of a tour, come on out and see me. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy where I live. I'm a third generation Angeleno here, and all of my books are set in Los Angeles, which is, I guess, if I was smart, I would set them in places like Hawaii and, Ireland, and go do research.
Yeah, so, I was in Spain the other week on a research trip. So, yeah, I do that all the time. But come on, something from your misspent youth. There must be something.
Wow. Misspent youth. What are you trying to incriminate me? Because I know that the Fifth Amendment protects me on this.
You must have had a dangerous hobby, or, you know, paper cut or scars.
Well, you know, I did go to the University of California, Santa Barbara, in the 70s, which was kind of a wild place. Now, I hate to say it, but, you know, my class level, when I got in there, we had just the class before us had shown, you know, their big political move was to burn the Bank of America, and they were into political rallies and taking over administration offices. My class, we were into streaking.
Ooh.
And so that's not very much to brag about as far as, you know, a cultural transformative moment. But we just, you know, it was college days, and we did that, and I used to play a lot of poker.
Oh, there we go. That's good. One day I'll come and have a drink with you and find out all the details.
Okay, and then it'll be on your international podcast, I'm sure.
Nobody will know. It's just you and me.
Okay, deal.
Okay, brilliant. So where can people find you and your books online?
It's at jamesscottbell.com.
Fantastic. And people can get Thrill Ride now and also your dazzling dialogue book. Thanks for your time, Jim. That was great.
Thank you, Joanna.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.